a period on as the British repressed the 1936 Arab revolt against British rule.
Yes, yes, indeed. The Nakba is a bit of a misleading term because it means in Arabic a catastrophe. But really, what the Palestinians suffered was not a natural catastrophe, but rather ethnic cleansing, which is a clear policy motivated by clear ideology. And that policy was part, an integral part, of the Zionist program for Palestine from the very inception of the movement in the late 19th century. Of course, very early on, they didn't have the capacity to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from their homeland. But already in the mid-1920s, when the Zionist community in Palestine was still very small, it was able, through purchase of land, on which there were many Palestinian villages, to convince the British mandatory power to evict 13 Palestinian villages, and that was in between 1925 and 1926. And then slowly this process of buying land and evicting the people who lived on this for hundreds of years brought the Zionist movement into a moment where it purchased at least 6% of the land of Palestine, which was, of course, not enough. And then they went to the big ethnic cleansing of 1948. But as we know, it didn't stop in 1948. Israel continued to expel Palestinian villages between 48 and 67 from among the Palestinian minority in Israel, which allegedly were citizens of Israel. Israel expelled 300,000 Palestinians during the Six Days War in June 1967. And since June 1967 until today, about 600,000 Palestinians, in one way or another, were dislocated and uprooted by Israel. And of course, now we have a magnitude of ethnic, or a case of ethnic cleansing that even overtakes the magnitude of the ethnic cleansing during 1948. So there is not one moment in the history of the Palestinians in Palestine since the arrival of Zionism in Palestine in which Palestinians are potentially under danger of losing their home, their fields, their businesses, and their homeland.
Finally, Ilan Pape, as you express, more Palestinians have been killed in the last months than at any point in the last 76 years. More Palestinians have been forced to move, have been displaced than what happened at the Nakba at the time of the founding of Israel. What gives you hope? You are an Israeli historian esteemed throughout the world. You have less than a minute.
Yes. I would say that what gives me hope is that I do think that the Zionist project in Israel and Palestine, as we see it today, doesn't have long to live, to exist. I think we are seeing processes, important processes, that are leading to the collapse of the Zionist project. Hopefully, the Palestinian National Movement and anyone else involved in Israel and Palestine would be able to replace this apartheid state, this oppressive regime, with a democratic one for everyone who lives between the river and the sea, and for all the Palestinians who were expelled from there since 1948 until today. I believe that this historical process has begun. Unfortunately, it will take time, and the next year or two are very precarious and are very dangerous. But in the long run, I'm really hopeful that there will be a different kind of life for both Jews and Arabs between the river and the sea under a democratic, free Palestine.
Ilan Pape, professor of history and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. Happy belated birthday to Samin Farkanday and today to Tamari Astudio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
Hello, and welcome to Breakfast for Dinner. This is DJ Chris Wired. You just heard the song Resurrection Fern from Iron and Wine. This is our Easter-themed episode of Breakfast for Dinner. It's not every song exactly about Easter, but, maybe sort of related to it. Anyway, I think you're going to enjoy it, whether you're celebrating Easter or not. But first, let's take care of a little business.
I just had another dizzy spell and almost fell. I'm scared they will get worse and never go away.
You're not alone. 69 million people suffer from dizziness and vertigo.
I wonder if there's help.
There is. The Vestibular Disorders Association has a helpline at 800-837-8428 or visit liferebalanced.org.
Can you repeat that?
800-837-8428 or liferebalanced.org.
Sponsored by the Vestibular Disorders Association.
Basement Show sounds on radio. Tune in to Punk Primers on Mondays at 11 p.m. for the music of DIY punk from our local scene and beyond. Every show spotlights new artists and some genres on WRCT Pittsburgh. Everyone thinks they know the 80s hits, but on the other side of the Atlantic lies a treasure trove of synth-drenched sounds that filled the airways of Europe back in the day. Take a trip back to the 80s you never knew with DJ Tony Tunes from Here to Eternity, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Okay, let's get back into it. Next up, we have the band Elbow with the song, Jesus is a Rochdale Girl.
I have a drop leaf window with cats and broken yards, sunflowers and paint cans, and stolen shopping carts. Nothing to be proud of, and nothing to regret. All of that to make us yet. All of that to make us yet. Single heartbreak, I celebrate and mourn. A single shining sister, and all the tricks of dawn. A single yellow duvet, a single switch to flick, but a thousand boxes yet to take. A thousand boxes yet to take. And Jesus is a Rochdale girl. 45 CDs. Got a house that you can smoke in. So all my friends found me, and they found me full of myself.
worst of the best was on the field, the gray and the green together, the noise of a distant farm machine, out of the first light came, a tattered necklace of hedge and trees, the southern side. Where the border runs between, where Mary Denise boy fell.
past the chillest towns, past my window. I can see a washed out moon through the fog. And then a voice inside my head breaks the analog and says, follow me down to the valley below. You know, moonlight is bleeding from out of your soul. Against the will of my twisted fog, but in the deafness of my world, silence broke.
That is Manic Street Preachers with The Everlasting. Before that, Porcupine Tree with Lazarus. Marillion with the song Easter. And we started that set off with Elbow and Jesus is a Rochdale Girl.
Support comes from Sidecar Bakery in North Oakland. Whether you're looking for a casual place to study or a great place to meet friends, we are here for you. Always serving scratch-made pastries, a full coffee bar, and six-packs to go in a cozy cafe setting. Open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. If you're interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities.
Stress may feel like a constant and one that may lead to heart disease and stroke. But what if we focus on what we can control and turn those stressful minutes into our me time? Sometimes just taking a deep breath can make a difference. Or going on a short walk, maybe even taking a nap to recharge. Managing your stress means managing your health, so it's important to take back your moments. This is your me time. Own it. Learn more about reducing stress at heart.org/stress.
Okay, back at it. Next up, Patti Smith Group with the song Easter.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you and I may know that the 2020 election was not stolen from Donald Trump through various mysterious sorts of skullduggery. That doesn't mean that we can whistle past the fact that many people who vote do believe that. Many of those people are activated in a way that goes beyond easily ignorable segments on OAN and have meaning for November. Stephen Rosenfeld reports on transparency, among other electoral issues, for VotingBooth.media. We'll hear from him about kinds of election interference we ignore at our peril. Also on the show, you and I may believe that democracy means something like one person, one vote. That doesn't mean we can whistle past the fact that many voting people do not believe that. Indeed, some elite media designated smart people have determined that Citizens United what? It's actually folks who give 10 bucks to a candidate that are really messing up the system. We'll explore that notion with Ian Vandewalker, Senior Counsel of the Elections and Government Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The big lie that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump has proven surprisingly tenacious, perhaps in part because it is so big and vague, and perhaps in part due to a corporate press corps that are constitutionally incapable of saying sometimes there are not two sides with the truth in the middle. Based on the tenacity and the utility of that lie, Trumpists are continuing the work of undermining U.S. electoral processes in the run-up to the 2024 race. Besides saying, Trump, am I right? Is there more we might do to break through the disinformation and gird ourselves for similar future efforts? Stephen Rosenfeld reports on transparency and other electoral issues for VotingBooth.media. He joins us now by phone from California. Welcome back to Counterspin, Stephen Rosenfeld.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
I want to ask you about the election education channel that you've written about, but first, just some context. Even if you don't think anyone's going to go back and say Trump actually won, there is a possibility of creating enough chaos, confusion, and controversy around elections that people can say, well, I don't know what went on, so I'll believe who I want to believe. Trumpists don't have to convince you of the big lie if they sow enough doubt. That's kind of the playing field we're on.
Well, that is true. If you think about what happened since 2020, there were 60-something lawsuits, election challenges filed after Election Day by Trump and his allies in the Republican Party and other nonprofits that are aligned with Republicans. Courts, unlike state legislatures and political campaigns, actually have rules of evidence. You're not allowed to lie in court. If you go into court and you present lies and you can't back things up with evidence or facts that can be duplicated by somebody else, you'll lose your law license. And that's what's happened with Rudy Giuliani and a whole bunch of others. But winning in the court of legal opinion is not the same as winning in the court of public opinion. So what's happened since 2020 is these legislators in states like Arizona and other places have created these audits and these investigations where the goal really was not to prove that Trump won, but it was to get on the news week after week and month after month, especially on the television channels and the online platforms that are, you know, are favored by the Trump supporters and right-wingers, and just plant those seeds of doubt. They'd have people on these channels, and they'd talk about technical things that no one could understand, but people would just nod and go, okay, okay. And so what you ended up getting was you can win in court, but lose in the court of public opinion. So these folks have basically been winning the propaganda war, and they've been doing it, just as you said, by planting seeds of doubt and basically saying political tribal loyalties, like, you know, how could that possibly happen? All this kind of stuff. And that's brought us to today.
Well, who is this? Because it's a particular example. It's not a sole example, but it is a kind of epicenter of this kind of thing. You looked at the Election Education Channel on Telegram. Tell us a little about what that is and what they are up to that is currently and potentially meaningful.
When I was on the floor of the Arizona recount, which was in an old basketball arena in Phoenix, this was run by the Cyber Ninjas, and the state senate in that state said, we're going to take possession of all the ballots in Maricopa County, which is, second or third largest jurisdiction in the country. So 1.2 million ballots. They had a lot of volunteers come in who were basically patriotic citizens who thought, my God, something went wrong. I got to do something to help figure out what happened. So a lot of these folks are emblematic of the grassroots wing of the election integrity movement or the pro-Trump part of the Republican Party. They call themselves an election integrity movement. So they went to other platforms like Parler and Telegram, and they stayed in touch there. Now, this is not the same as the people who have really tried to become professional agitators, the people like Mike Lindell and mm-hmm. others who've gone around the country speaking at Republican Party county meetings and, you know, have basically turned their livelihoods into holding forth with all these conspiracies that were based on things they claimed were happening and couldn't be proven, and invisible hidden hands and, you know, the world's out to get us kind of stuff. And I'm not making any of this up. I won't get into the details. The point is the details are really hard to follow, but people just nod and go along. But below that, to answer your question, is on these pro-Trump, right-of-center social media platforms, you have these channels, they're sort of pages, where people share information and they talk and they communicate and they have a community there. And I would periodically go and see what these folks are saying. And I found this one channel on Telegram, which is one of the platforms, and it's called the Election Education Channel. And it's run by a woman who is based in Washington State. And she is different than the folks who are in Trump's immediate orbit, because the folks in Trump's immediate orbit will say, there'll be a lot of cliches. It was stolen. It was electronically hacked. Oh, they're fabricating voters. Oh, they're making up voter lists. Oh, they're stealing ballots. Mm-hmm. These folks, instead, at this Election Education Channel, they decided to try to learn about the way elections work. And what I mean by that is there are a lot of subsystems and steps with a lot of bureaucratic and technical procedures that really follow the start to the finish of elections. So the whole voter registration system has its own rules and its own data. And then the whole ballot counting system, the vote counting system, is another set of computers and analytics and records and data. So they've discovered this. And what they've tried to do is they've tried to teach themselves about it, because they don't trust talking to election officials, and election officials most often don't really want to talk to them, or they lose patience. So what's happened is these folks, especially on this Election Education Channel, I found more than 100 really pretty well done graphics. It's not like a bumper sticker, but they're charts that can be read in 5 or 10 seconds. And they have identified all these little steps and technicalities of running elections. And everywhere possible, they try to figure out how can this be used against us. So they're emblematic of the phrase or cliche that a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing.
Right.
Because they're starting with something that's factual, and they just spin off the deep end. And they come from this mindset, well, anything that can be done against us will be done against us. And if anything is possible, it means it probably is happening somewhere. And even if something, you know, people are trying to operate in good faith, like poll workers, they don't know what's happening invisibly inside their machines. And they just go on and on this way. And this is really different from the people surrounding Trump at the end of 2020, because they're not just targeting the candidate, they're targeting the system. When things get close in the fall, if they are close, it's going to be, you know, a zillion targets.
So they've identified, they've broken down the different steps in the election process, and they're saying every step of the way there can be subterfuge.
let's just put this in the context of what you're hearing about right now. So in early May, the governor of Georgia signed a bill that allows mass election challenges or challenges of voter registrations. And this had been in law before. And literally, less than 10 people in 2020 tried to challenge the voter registrations of over 100,000 voters who obviously predominantly lived in the Democratic epicenters, the blue cities, lower-income communities, college campuses, and things like that. So the governor signed a bill allowing this to actually be expanded 6 months from now towards the 24 presidential election in November. What you have is in these narratives as a backdrop, what you read on the Trump social media channels is it's the Democrats are fabricating voters. The voter lists are actually not up to date. And that's on purpose because what they're doing is they're finding people who are not voting and they're filling out ballots in their names. And they're doing this electronically and they're doing this with mailed out ballots and they're doing it on election day so that when they find out that people haven't come in, they can just push through 5 or 10,000 votes as needed. And this is how they're going to screw us. And that level of paranoia, I could tell you practically why that is very unlikely, because there are too many other checks and balances in the actual data and records to get away with something like that where it wouldn't be caught very early and immediately and quarantined and found and fixed and corrected. But the point, what I'm saying is, this is the rhetoric and the crazy making around just this one little step at the start of the process. So what people in the mainstream media and in election defense circles have not acknowledged is this same level of focus and what I would call craziness or paranoia, they've got scripts or scenarios every step of the way through the final certification, which comes weeks after election day. They don't trust the machines, or they don't trust the testing. They don't trust how ballots might be delivered from a voting site to a counting center. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on. They don't know what they don't know. So what do I mean by that? They do not know, or they never say, what security measures might be in place to quarantine problems.
Right.
They don't know what other data or records occur upstream might be used to double check and say, wait a second, this isn't right. It doesn't match. They don't know, and they never say, what is the scale of the posed impacts here? Are we talking about 10 or 100 or 1,000 votes? So it becomes this crazy-making, spinning kind of mindset that will never be satisfied. And even if you respond to one thing, there's always going to be something else. It's always going to be a what about this and what about that?
Well, I want to say a few things. One, that you've actually said, but just to lift them up. For one thing, to show that it's a rhetorical kind of thing, these folks are not saying, if you did this, then I would believe that the process was clean. They're not offering solutions. They're not offering things that might be done to be introduced in the process, and then we would accept the results. They are emphatically not doing that. And then let me just tack on to that. You have written, actually, voting systems are not black boxes. You know, there is data. There is ballot-centered evidence that can be verified. So it's two things. It's both there are things that we can use to check and to make these processes transparent, and also they don't want to do that. They don't want agreed-upon evidentiary-based things that we can all see and say, all right, this actually went according to rules.
That's exactly right. For example, the attorney general's race in Arizona, after the official result was in, there was several hundred vote margin, which means it went to an official recount. It turned out that in one county, they didn't count 500 votes, 500 ballots. And if people knew what to look for to basically make sure that the number of voters equals the number of ballots, very early on, they would have seen there was an inventory problem. There was a mismatch. But instead, it took 9 weeks nearly. It was late December before that recount was over. And in that 9-week period, you can just imagine, you know, the volume of partisan propaganda that occurred. So what's happening is these folks, they're learning about how elections work. They don't know, or they didn't know then, where to look to basically solve, you know, like the most basic questions. Does the number of ballots equal the number of voters? And then you can drill down. You can make sure that the votes on each ballot, if they're not totally sloppy, match what's in the final spreadsheet. And if you want to argue about the sloppy ballots, you can find them very quickly. That's what lawyers argue over in recounts. You know, do I have a vote? Is it for my candidate or the other candidate or neither of us? And they don't do any of that.
Well, finally, I know that you have heard, let's just not talk about these people. That only elevates them. That only spotlights them. And I guess I see what people are saying. But at the same time, Trump won in 2016. He became the freaking president based on all manner of nonsense and straight up lying. And so I don't know what we get from ignoring that. But we should certainly come at it smarter. And so I want to ask you, what would you be asking from reporters? And I want to say, especially at the local level, you know, we can get big chin scratching ideas, pieces in the national media, but local reporting on the election is going to be really meaningful. What happened here? What actually happened? What role do you see for reporters who aren't, like you, specifically dedicated to issues of electoral processes and transparency, but they're going to be the ones that we look to for reporting claims of fraud or claims of poll worker bias and so on in November? What would you like to put in reporters' minds, maybe?
Well, I can tell you very simply, most local reporters, and this is also true of the people who come to observe elections, they don't know what they're seeing. They're standing behind a stanchion or at a distance, and they don't really know what people are looking at as they're shuffling ballot return envelopes or ballots or looking at a computer screen to check signatures or something else. What I would hope is that people who actually know the way things work could do some proactive education to tell journalists who are going to be covering the swing counties and the swing states to literally help them understand what they are seeing as the process inches forward. It's not hard to do if you know what to look for. There aren't that many key decision points. And at least at that point, at the very worst, if the counting takes days or weeks and the editors are saying, I need a story by 5 o'clock, what are you going to do? What do you got? Mm-hmm. At least then you will actually be covering what's real instead of covering the made-up crazy things like, you know, the ballots are being smuggled in the next room. At least it could come back to what's real as opposed to what's made up. And I think that's the best we can hope for, is to try to nip the disinformation rumors in the bud. And that's where they'll start, in these swing counties, in these swing states, with these local reporters and local influencers.
All right, then we'll end it there for now. We've been speaking with Stephen Rosenfeld. You can find his piece, Trump Loyalists Preview Strategies to Upend 2024 Election, online at votingbooth.media. Stephen Rosenfeld, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
If you ask people to boil down what democracy means, many will say one person, one vote. If powerful people, rich people get more voice, it's not democracy. Even as practices and policies have moved us materially further from that reality, that's still the selling point. Even the reason the U.S. can invade other places is they don't believe in democracy like we do. Now we see more and more people saying, well, democracy shouldn't actually mean everyone gets equal voice, but we would like to keep using the label. You can forgive a person for being a bit confused. And since courts have declared that money is speech, you can forgive a person for being more confused. That's the landscape in which the latest fillip seems to be that people who give small amounts of money to political campaigns somehow have outsized voice. Here to help us make sense of that is Ian VandeWalker. He's senior counsel of the Elections and Government Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Ian VandeWalker.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I will say, when I first saw the headline of your report, Do Small Donors Cause Political Dysfunction? I thought, huh? You know, who would say that? It turns out it's a number of folks, including author and New York Times writer Thomas Edsel, who wrote, "For $200, a person can fuel the decline of our major parties." And then David Beiler at The Washington Post wrote, "Small dollar donors didn't save democracy. They made it worse." So this is not like a subreddit, you know, obscure line of thought. So before I ask you to engage it, putting the best face on it, what is the argument here?
Well, the argument is sort of this contrarian line that you think small donors are sort of democratizing because anybody can be one. But if you look at who gets a lot of small money, it tends to be people who engage in disruptive antics like Marjorie Taylor Greene or Matt Gaetz, people who try to attract a lot of attention with whether extremist rhetoric or polarizing rhetoric. And so the argument is, well, what small donors are really doing is they're encouraging these people who are sort of showboating and not engaged in serious moderation or governance.
Well, so the idea, though, is it that these small donors aren't real, that they're kind of orchestrated, that these, folks are trying to get folks to just give $12 to make some kind of point, and it's not that actually it's people who can only give $12, you know?
Right. I mean, I think there's something here in that the media ecosystem that we live in, both the mainstream media and sort of social media clickbait, does gravitate towards outrage and controversy and people screaming at each other. Mm-hmm. We all get these fundraising emails with all caps, "The world's going to come crashing down if you don't send me $12.
Right.
So I think there are incentives in the sort of media system that say to certain people, I can engage a national small donor fundraising base by saying crazy things.
Yeah.
Like that exists. Now, one of the critiques is that most small donors don't actually respond to that. Small donors tend to give to competitive races where they think they can help their party win control of a chamber of Congress or the White House.
So, first of all, I like how you go right to the media ecosystem. You know, I think a lot of folks, well, there's a political system and there's a media system and they're different.
Mm-hmm.
You're already saying, no, these things are intimately integrated.
Yes. Campaign fundraising doesn't happen in a vacuum. And
Right. Look,
the internet has been a huge beneficial force for fundraising and allows people to connect across the nation to things that they believe in. But one of the other effects of that has been this clickbait world of say the most outrageous thing in order to get the clicks and get the small dollar fundraising. There's a question whether these candidates that engage in this kind of extremist rhetoric, are they doing it for the small dollar fundraising or would they be doing it anyway, given who votes in their district,
right?
I think is a question we should also look into.
Well, there is a reality. There is a foot we can keep on base. And so what do you say in this piece about when you actually investigate, are small donors causing political dysfunction? What did you find?
So first of all, there's lots of reasons for polarization, you know, people moving farther to the right and left and other kinds of dysfunction. They have to do with gerrymandering and the media ecosystem and the parties making strategic choices about how they're going to engage their voter bases and things that have nothing to do with campaign finance. As I said, small donors, they give to people they've heard of. So one way to get heard of is to say crazy things, but it's certainly not the only way. Some candidates are trying to find, you know, policy solutions to the problems that face us. And the other thing we haven't mentioned yet is big donors.
Right.
Even though the amount of small money in the system has dramatically increased, the money from the biggest donors, people who give millions, 10 millions, has increased even faster. So that's actually the biggest part of the campaign finance system is this big money. And those people give to extremists as well. So it's hard to say when you look at all those facts together that small donors are sort of causing dysfunction or polarization, even though there are these notorious examples of extremists who raise lots of small money.
It just sounds weird to say that people who can give less, people who don't have $1 million, they're throwing in their money wherever they throw it, is throwing off the system. You know, it makes you ask, well, what's the system? Is the system that only people who can afford to give tens of thousands of dollars should be included? It just sounds weird.
Yeah, that's right. I think one of the things, the sort of thought experiments I like to do with these arguments is, well, replace small donor with voter, right? If small donors give a lot of money to a candidate because they believe in that candidate, okay, that's just like voters voting for a candidate because they believe in that candidate. And it's hard to say that that's, as you say, a problem with the system itself.
You know, obviously every election year is important, but hoo boy, 2024. Thoughts for reporters who are going to be engaging this?
Yeah, I think for reporters, it's important to get away from the high-profile anecdotes. It's easy to say, oh, Marjorie Taylor Greene raised a bunch of small money, but there's data out there that can show you what are small donors actually doing across the entire system, and that's a very different story. And as for reforms, so the Brennan Center supports a small donor public financing system that matches small donations. So it amplifies those amounts from regular people to make them competitive with the big donors. And that changes the way the candidates fundraise and makes them fundraise by essentially asking people in their communities for votes. And so it amplifies those regular people's voices and engages a kind of connection between elected representative and constituent that's good for representative democracy because politicians are listening to the voters in another way.
All right, then. And we'll have another conversation about the role of money in politics generally. And why do you have to have money to participate? That's a whole bigger conversation.
Yes, definitely. There's a lot to say about the uniquely American way of running politics with private dollars and the biggest donors calling the tune.
All right, then. Well, for now, we've been speaking with Ian Vandewalker. He's senior counsel of the Elections and Government Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Thank you so much, Ian Vandewalker, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is brought to you by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find all of that on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
CT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT
WRCT
Pittsburgh. We own
everything.
And your soul is next.
We don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
Yeah.
Might as well
kind of the only thing left to do. Oh, we ain't giving up. We're just changing our stuff. Adding a little twang to this brew. Well, I'm trading this old axe for some steel. I'm tired of playing it fast. Let's get real. Find some Georgia pine and settle down. Cause we're sick and tired of hearing them loud guitars. We dig the Nashville sound. We're going country. That's our style. We're going country for a while. I don't care if you're listening. I don't give a damn what you think of it. We're going country. We're going country. Tried flamenco. Well, that really stank, though. The truth be told, we really blew. Lord knows we tried Celtic, but them faces were melted. When all was said and done, man, we should have been through. Well, now I might as well get up and go to work. Trade this old guitar for a tie and shirt. Dedicated my life to the Lord. And there's one damn thing I surely know. I really hate rock and roll. We're going country, and that's our style. We're going country for a while. I don't care if you're listening. I don't give a damn what you think of it. We're going country. We're going country. Changing our shit. Say, why don't you bring me down that bottle over here and I'll tell you a little story. Because I'm gonna look like a damn son of a Sam. Really hate rock and roll. We're going country. That's our style.